This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. So the big doomsday recession everyone seemed to be predicting for 2023 and the year before that, well, we did dodge it again. And inflation? Slowing down. So there was good economic news. At the same time, here in Massachusetts, we've got our own challenges to deal with: labor shortages, high costs, and the mother of all economic problems in the Commonwealth, housing. And maybe we'll throw transit in there, too, just for good measure. So today, we want to catch you up on the state of our local economy, what happened in 23, what to look out for in 2024, especially from a business perspective. So to help us do that, we have several people with us today. Brooke Thompson leads Associated Industries of Massachusetts, representing employers in the state. Darlene Lombos is the Executive Secretary Treasurer of the Greater Boston Labor Council, which represents thousands of union workers. Tomas Gonzalez is the Director of Community at Amplify Latinx, which helps small businesses get off the ground, among other things. And Jen Fagel is co-founder and executive director of the nonprofit Commonwealth Kitchen. So let's go down the line. Brooke, welcome back.
Hello. Good to be here.
Great to have you. Tomas, welcome.
It's a pleasure to be here. Thank you.
Great to have you. Jen, welcome back.
Thank you. So good to be here.
And Darlene, welcome.
Thank you so much for inviting me.
So we've got kind of three big themes that I want to talk about today. I want to talk some about leadership challenges in 23. We definitely need to talk about workers, hiring, workforce, and we'll need to spend some time looking ahead, of course, into this 2024. I want to start, though, with 23, you know, kissing it goodbye, mwah, in the rearview mirror. And yet, what were the big business leadership challenges? And Brooke, I'll start with you. In your mind, 2023, big business leadership challenges.
Sure. You know, the biggest thing that we've seen at Associated Industries is the direct effect of our demographic loss. So we're seeing that even though we have unemployment really, really low, the number one issue that I hear time and time again from the business community is they cannot find qualified talent to hire. And I think you can draw a straight line from that to the fact that we're really seeing some shifts in behavior. We have lost, you know, close to 300,000 people in the last 3 years. I even have some anecdotal news from a conversation I had just a few days ago where, you know, it sometimes takes a while for the data to come in and there can be a lag. But folks who work in the financial services industry said, you know, when they're seeing people open accounts or transferring where their primary place of residence is, they're seeing a dramatic shift to Texas, to New Hampshire, and to the Carolinas and Florida, and movement out of places like Massachusetts. And so I think, you know, the biggest takeaway from 2023 from our members is we're losing that valuable talent, and we need to work aggressively, collectively, to retain it.
So I'll turn to you next, Jen Fagel, because of this group, you're the one who was on this panel at the beginning of 2023, mm-hmm. right? When we looked at, we're looking ahead of 2023, and hiring was a big thing we were thinking about at mm-hmm. the time, but there were a number of other deeply personal challenges that people spoke about as well. And of course, I'm mindful that that time, we were a year closer to the depths of the COVID-19 pandemic mm-hmm. as well. We're in a different place now. But 2023, as you look back, the big leadership challenge or challenges top of mind for you?
Yeah. So in some ways, it's similar to Brooke, where labor shortages and hiring is a challenge. But there's a double-edged sword, a double-sided coin to this, because when there are shortages in the food industry, it also means there's more opportunity for smaller businesses to step in. So as much as we have seen real challenges in our own staff of trying to hire and find folks who want to work not in a hybrid situation and come in every day, and same with our
Commonwealth Kitchen.
At Commonwealth Kitchen in Dorchester. At the same time, we are, and our businesses are struggling as well to find folks to work on their food trucks or in their catering businesses or in their retail stores. At the same time, many of the buyers and industry partners we work with colleges and hospitals and office buildings, because they are also struggling with labor, there's been this interesting opportunity for our businesses to step in and get sales, get new partnerships, whether that be work with Northeastern on pop-up shops or MIT graduation, where our businesses have actually had enormous opportunity that they haven't seen before.
So if they can plug into where some other business is experiencing a shortage, actually maybe there's something good there.
Correct. There is an upside to this. Hopefully it's not short-lived. We're obviously concerned about, as the market continues to shift, and in the world of food, we as consumers are all eating differently, right? We're not eating out as much, right? The office workers aren't going in as much. Online is a thing. Delivery is a thing. And so all of those behavior changes make it really hard to predict what's coming, and therefore for our business owners to really have a really good business strategy going forward. And so very often our best advice to people is differentiate, have multiple ways that you're running your business. You can't rely just on, you know, people walking into your restaurant or a food truck only doing lunch downtown. And so think about other ways to support yourself, and also always be watching for what are those new trends and where are the new opportunities.
So, Darlene Lombos, I'll turn to you next, because we just had a conversation with historians, right, where we ask them what in history helps us sort of look ahead into 2024. And one of those historians noted that 2023 was a year for labor, for labor movements, unlike anything they'd seen in 50 years of history. So 2023, you know, for the Greater Boston Labor Council, the business and leadership challenges in a year where labor had a historic year.
Yeah, I think it's pretty inspiring, exciting to see the way that workers are taking action on their own, even without a union. They want a union. In fact, every industry, there is a union for you. Just want to make sure that workers who are organizing know that there is a union for you in every industry and every sector. And in terms of these labor shortages, I think it's interesting because while we did see in some industries, you know, a mass exodus of women from some of the industries like childcare, like teaching, like nursing.
So in 2023, you saw a mass exodus of women from those industries?
Oh, I think we're just recovering from some of the what happened during COVID and the years that followed. I would actually say that there's not a labor shortage in most industries. There's just more workers that are demanding more, that are actually saying they deserve more. They deserve better wages. They deserve respect on the job. They deserve more than what they've gotten before. And we're hearing from workers themselves, there's not a labor shortage. There's actually a demand for better working conditions. And so I think I want to make sure that people understand that not all industries are suffering from a labor shortage.
So Tomas Gonzalez, you're director of community at Amplify Latinx. And my understanding is one of the things that in your work you're looking at is a kind of entrepreneurship that often falls off the radar screen with micro businesses. And I wonder, in that perspective, was there something unique to a set of challenges in 2023?
Well, thank you for having me here.
Yeah.
I mean, as we said earlier, and we talked about history, the pandemic was widespread. It had tremendous disruption for small businesses and historically disadvantages for women and people of color. Between February 2020 and April 2020, the pandemic caused 22% of businesses in the U.S. to close. That is the largest drop on record. In short, micro and small businesses aren't doing well because small businesses, for the most part, when you're trying to scale and grow, you're looking for procurement opportunities. You're hoping that the state, private and public, has this equity lens. But oftentimes, they're outbid by larger organizations, people more familiar with the process. And in the bidding process, in the low bidding process, when you're trying to grow and scale your business, you have to take into consideration big factors, employment, things that larger businesses can, you know, do and scale that you couldn't do. So, you know, the state of affairs is pretty rough for micro and small businesses now. The groups that we look at, which represent 32,000, so and a business that has 250,000 gross revenue or less and 9 employees or less, typically have 1 to 3 employees. And so they don't, not that they don't have a labor shortage themselves, but it's really family and friends operating businesses. They're the rubber, where the rubber hits the road. That's that place that you walk into every single day. You know, you don't see the owner of McDonald's But you see the owner of the pizza shop, the dry cleaner, the beauty shop. And those are the people we can't forget in this equation. They represent 10% of all businesses in this state.
So that then, all right, and let me just remind everybody, we're here looking at the state of the economy and business in 2023. Right now we're looking at challenges that we faced across that in 2023 as we prepare to kind of set our heads for what 2024 is likely to bring. You've just heard Tomas Gonzalez of Amplify Latinx, also with us Darlene Lombos of Greater Boston Labor Council, Jen Fagel of Commonwealth Kitchen, and Brooke Thompson of Associated Industries of Massachusetts. And Jen and Brooke both representing very different kinds of businesses, mm-hmm. but both nodding vigorously to the things that Tomas said. So let me just have you both jump in and go.
Yes, absolutely. And I couldn't agree with Tomas more. And, you know, we see it because, you know, at AIM, we represent businesses of all sizes and all industries across the state. And so some of the challenges that have happened in 2023 are universal across industry and across region, and some are very different. But I think to dovetail on something that Jen said, with the challenges, we're trying to look at opportunities. And to what Tomas said, you know, at AIM, we actually launched AIM Business Connect. And the goal of AIM Business Connect was to do exactly what Tomas was talking about. We recognize that at AIM, we have 3,400 business members. Well, oftentimes they are looking to try to make connections with women or minority-owned businesses so that they can increase their diversity spend. But they don't always know how to navigate that process. They don't know how to meet the pizza shop owner, right? They don't know how to meet somebody who's manufacturing something that maybe they don't have a connection with. And so ABC was an opportunity to try to connect those folks to create different opportunities for contracts, for purchasing in this time when it's particularly difficult for those folks around issues like lending, capital, finding those connections. So I do think, to Jen's point, what we have to do during these still really challenging times is try to pivot to where we can make some differences around the edges.
Jen, go ahead.
Yeah, I think that's right, that what we see is where opportunity also comes complexity. And so when we think about where the opportunity with the colleges and hospitals, as an example of these big anchor institutions that are doing a ton of buying across industry, and where is the opportunity to work with them, a lot of that requires them to change behavior. And so readiness to change behavior is not just that one person saying, yes, I want to do this. It's not just the CEO. It's not just the procurement officer. And so we often talk about readiness to change, that change happens at the speed of trust. And if we don't learn how to trust each other in the conversations that we're having about how, in our case, you know, a big office building can be working with a minority-owned catering company and why that's actually better for them for business, that if they're not going to engage in that and we move into something that's very transactional rather than relational, we don't actually change the opportunity for these business owners.
So keep going. Didn't realize you weren't done.
No, just to say that what we see very often, particularly because we are largely working with women and immigrant and BIPOC-owned businesses, is how often that those bigger companies want to use them, but once. And so how do we take what are the crumbs and turn them into the loaf of bread?
All right. So, Tomas, you're nodding. Jump back in.
Yeah, no, absolutely. 100% on board. I was listening to that and just thinking of how these opportunities exist, but there are also these perpetual challenges, right? So, yep, I just got that. But some company now says that the bond that you need on a project went from $1 million to $10 million.
Is that insurance, the bond?
Yep, you have to do these large projects. And so how does a company that's really small, mostly minority owned, are able to make that shift? That's a big movement in contract language. And that's not relational. Like, you're literally shutting the door down and saying, this is for specific people only.
You are listening to Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering, continuing a conversation as we launch into a new year. I'm chuckling because goodness knows what this new year is going to hold for us. And we're looking at the economy, business, what's on the table, what needs to be the table at the table, and what challenges lie ahead here in the Commonwealth of Massachusetts. Still with us, Darlene Lombos, Executive Secretary Treasurer of the Greater Boston Labor Council, Tomas Gonzalez, Director of Community at Amplify Latinx, Jen Fagel, co-founder and executive director of the nonprofit Commonwealth Kitchen, and Brooke Thompson, head of Associated Industries of Massachusetts. And Darlene Lambos, I'll turn to you. I set this up a minute ago. As we begin to think now about hiring, who's working, where they want to work, how we begin to deal with challenges of labor shortages, whether by design, by demographics, or by unwillingness to pay. Let's start there. You said, hey, it may not be that there aren't people available to work. They may just not want to work on your terms. So why don't you pick it up there?
Yeah, I think I would pick it up by just looking at the opportunities, because we have such an incredible opportunity with this administration, with the Biden-Harris administration, with the federal infrastructure funds that are actually creating partnerships with in new ways and actually have what we would frame as a potential for a triple win framework. This means that these infrastructure dollars could be used to both make sure that there are good jobs, union career pathways for women and people of color in environmental justice communities. And so we're
So I'm going to stop you there because I did not see federal infrastructure funds coming, right? So I wasn't expecting that. So specifically, what would they go to?
So there are a number. There's $1.2 trillion that the federal government is giving to states and cities through competitive grants and formula funding, and are requiring specifically to support the work of women and people of color into these jobs, particularly to deal with the climate crisis and make sure that environmental justice communities have the bulk of these funds, and to ensure that union career pathways are at the center of all of these projects. So we're really partnering with our cities and states to ensure that those tools that were given to us by the Biden-Harris administration are actually on the ground real. And it's really important for us to really think about how to disrupt the way that the workforce development system has operated with this train and pray model where people of color, women, are given a certificate and you're asked to go find a job, whereas in an apprenticeship model, pre-apprenticeship, there are actual pathways for union careers with union employers. And that's the kind of partnerships we want to see happen to ensure that our communities, communities of color, environmental justice communities, are partnering with unions to make sure that path grows and ensures a strong, unionized, trained workforce.
Okay, and according to the White House, in 2022, $2 billion in bipartisan infrastructure law funding had been announced and was headed to the Commonwealth with over 50 specific projects identified for funding. Okay, so what I want to do is I want to put that in a bubble, right, over the table, because I want to put a few things in bubbles over the table, right? So there's one. Now, Brooke Thompson, I'm going to put also in a bubble over the table the data that we have that says that we are seeing an outflow of people ages 25 to 35, right?
Yes.
So I want all these things up here, right? So go on that one.
So that is the largest, if you look at all of the age groups, that is the age group that is leaving Massachusetts in the largest numbers. I think it hovers somewhere around 35%. And those are the folks like me who grew up somewhere else, who came to Massachusetts to go to school, and I stayed here, and I raised a family, and I worked. And that's what we need to get back to. At AIM, what we, and I think, you know, I agree with Darlene and Jen and Tomas, I think we're all saying the same thing. It's really about making Massachusetts the place you want to be. And I think for our business members, it's making them the employer of choice. It's making them realize that if they want to get that talented workforce, right, if they want to get the best people, then they have to step up and adapt and change and find new ways to attract talent. I also think, and this is something we're laser focused on, it's not just the business behavior, though. It's all of the other things that people take into account when they're deciding where to live and to work and to raise a family. And right now, we have a real issue with availability and affordability of housing, the reliability of transportation, because if you're not going to live close to where you work, then you're going to have to get to work reliably and affordably. And then another issue, and Darlene spoke about this, the rate at which the COVID pandemic impacted women in the workforce and the absolute decimation to the childcare industry that has not recovered. And we really do have to take a hard look at Are we providing the opportunities to those working families, to those caregivers? And it's not just, you know, when we talk about caregiving, we have to be more expansive than just childcare. We also have populations right now that are caring for children and aging parents. And are we providing that support so that Massachusetts is the place that they come and they work? And then in turn, that leads to success on the business side that helps us grow our economy.
So, okay, we're going to put that piece now up here, too. So we've got the infrastructure money and the potential here. We've got the outflow of young people, especially age 25 to 35. We've begun to talk about the challenges in housing and transportation. There are a couple of other things that I want to put on the table. And Tomas, I'll turn to you here. I'm going to ask a question. You can also obviously feel free to add to the two bubbles we've already got floating overhead. And I am thinking about the Boston Foundation report, first done in 2021 and updated in 2023, that also very clearly said that businesses of color and entrepreneurs of color in the state do not get capital the same way that other businesses do. And as the gap post-COVID for white-owned businesses closed, it didn't for businesses of color. And we knew that during the pandemic, you needed strong banking relationships to be able to take advantage of all the kinds of pandemic money that was out there, like the Payroll Protection Program, and that you were more likely to have weak banking relationships if you were a business of color. And then we add in micro-businesses, right, the super, super, super small businesses. And it feels like that is just sort of racked and stacked. I'm thinking of all the mattresses, right, with the pee underneath down here. And almost the other bubbles almost don't seem to matter if you're looking at that, Tomas.
I think one of the things that we looked at, and one other issue or underlying problem is, are you actually have a legal status that's not a DBA?
Not doing business as is what a DBA is.
And so an LLC or an LLP.
Limited liability corporation, just trying to help our listeners.
Exactly. Yep. And so if you don't have a registered business that way and you're operating under DBA, you didn't have access to any of that federal funding, state funding, a lot of those opportunities, which sort of helped or hurt the situation even more. And so there are a lot of micro businesses that we come across that suffer from this problem, taxes, like there are, it just ripples. And so one of the things that we try to do is take a step back and try to work with them where they are. We have a very curated approach at Amplify Small Business Advancement Program to make sure that whether it's a child care facility, which 40% of our businesses were last year, or a restaurant or someone who is doing manufacturing, that they get that one-on-one support to know how to, one, get back on track. If you don't have legal status, provide the support so you get the legal status, because the tax implications are so huge to every single person if that's not right for your business. And oftentimes, as a child care, for example, they go into it for the passion, the love of the child, the education. They didn't go in thinking, oh my God, I got five different businesses that I'm navigating here between administration, between food, between marketing and all these other entities or pieces of business that wasn't in their mind when they first started out, but now they have to. And those are the businesses that don't get access to capital. That's the biggest thing that we're facing in our community, where it's the Black community, Latino community. Access to capital is hugely important. There are supports, CDFIs, CDCs, groups
community
like Ascendance.
Community Development Financial Corporations, that kind of thing, yeah?
Exactly. Community Development Finance Institutions or CDCs, Community Development Corporations, are all there to support in that regard. But even still, that's higher cost lending. And when they don't have access to that, they go into other areas and other people who are lending at even higher percentages. So it's dangerous for micro businesses to be out there and not have the ability to access capital.
We're speaking to Tomas Gonzalez, Darlene Lombos, Brooke Thompson, and Jen Fagel as we look at the business climate, economic climate in the Commonwealth, beginning 2024 and moving forward. So, Jen, that makes me think of Natalie LeCour, who's an owner and head chef at Gourmet Creole, came through Commonwealth Kitchen, your nonprofit. She was on our show really not within the last couple of months after receiving a contract to provide food through the state emergency shelter system, but then had to like scale up in some ways that she wasn't necessarily ready for. Here's a little bit of that.
I had to create so many forms in so many, like, honestly speaking, I didn't really have a real application way for my employees to even.
You didn't even have like a formal way to
yeah,
hire?
Yeah, like not even a, like, it's just insane how quick I had to just do everything, put protocols in place. And it really took over, like, I had to hire an admin, an assistant, kitchen managers. It was hard, but I did it, and I thank God for that.
And just to put it in perspective, she wound up with the potential for over $1 million in new business, but she had to hire what was like 10 new employees.
Correct.
Without really any of the experience to do any of that.
Correct. Yeah, so she's an example of that dichotomy of a Haitian immigrant woman starting a food truck without cash of her own, trying to figure out how to navigate permit, license, insurance, all of it. We were able to help get her started. Fantastic. Got her out on the street. COVID, who's going to the food trucks? So a challenge for her business, trying to figure out where to go next. A Haitian-owned business, we all are hearing all the statistics of all the immigrants and refugees that are getting dropped into Massachusetts and looking for ways to get culturally relevant food and connections. Amazing. So this is an amazing story for her as a business owner to have that opportunity to feed her community. Ended up hiring almost 14 full-time people to run that for her. That's incredible. And as she described it to me, wealth creation for her business. And yet, the enormous amount of effort it took to get her to that place is not insignificant. And I would say that, like, this is one of the challenges that we see across these small businesses. And in many ways, it's what Darlene was saying about the workers, right? You can't just train somebody for a job and then say, good luck, go find a job. Similarly, what we see across, certainly in the food industry, these businesses is, it is not enough to be a good cook. It is not enough to run a truck. It is not enough to be a finance person. You have to be able to have all of those pieces to connect those dots. There is no shame in that game. We all need that. And so I think really for all of us, the challenge now is to say, how are we as an industry that is supporting these small businesses organizing ourselves in a more powerful way to make the connections for those businesses to be successful?
And Jen, you couldn't have said it better. I really think, and again, a theme we've talked about here is turning challenges into opportunities. And I really think, again, if we're talking about how does Massachusetts set ourselves apart as being the competitive leader, that's just it. You've got organizations like Amplify. You've got the AFL-CIO. You have Commonwealth Kitchen. You have AIM. These are resources that can help these folks navigate these things. I also think the fact that you have, and if you know, you can just look, the Healy Driscoll administration has gone through the rigorous process of developing an economic development plan. You know, that's going to be turned into a bill in 2024. And, you know, part of that is exactly what we are all just talking about. Is there this business front door that can exist to help these folks that are small and they don't understand what all these nuances are and what all the issues are, the regulatory hurdles, the upscaling in no time. So they need those resources at the state level, which I think we're going to see come out of that economic development plan.
So we spoke with Governor Healy about this plan that she's got to really, you know, sort of throw the economy of the state forward further. And it was right after the plan came out. Just a little bit of sound from her here.
The exciting piece about this plan, and it's really the first time that an administration has ever done it this way, we spent the last several weeks, several months meeting with over, you know, 1,500 stakeholders, industry leaders, members of the public to say, hey, let's all come together, Team Massachusetts, put together a really terrific economic development plan for our state.
And, you know, it's in conjunction with $1 billion tax cuts that have been passed and a $4 billion plan for housing that the governor has on the table. And it's got infrastructure in it, and it's got new industries that the governor wants to invest in. And, you know, there's a lot there. At the same time, Darlene, here's what's sort of banging around the back of my head. When we had this conversation at this time last year, Jen was at this table, right? So was Corey Thomas, CEO of Boston cybersecurity giant Rapid7. And, you know, looking ahead and talking about the challenges of hiring, et cetera. Later in the year, they announced a layoff of more than 400 global employees, 18% of the global workforce. And the conversation around tech layoffs in 2023 was, it's not a bad thing. The tech industry isn't hurting. They're just shifting, right? And I get that. And I also get that that's 400 people who got laid off. And so there's also this churn, all of this economic development, right? The housing plan, the transit, and blah, blah, blah. But then there's this churn also where people are still having to try to pay rent and come up with first and last in security or a down payment on a house when in greater Boston, the median housing price is over $900,000 and in the state it's over $600,000. And squaring that circle feels impossible when you look at it just at face value, Darlene.
It's not impossible because
good.
Well, partly because we have unions. I mean, what many of these large corporations, Wall Street developers, have in mind is profits, not human dignity, human respect. That is not the first thing that is driving their business. And so unions are actually the thing that can neutralize and actually challenge that greed that we see has run amok in our society. And what's incredible about unions is that individuals first have to take that first step, have the courage and bravery to talk to another worker and say, hey, I'm having an issue. Are you having the issue? Hey, I'm having to pee in a bottle because I have no brakes when I'm delivering for Amazon. Is this happening to you too? And we try to understand that this is exactly what we talk about in terms of democracy. We are trying to get individuals to then talk to their coworkers, to then talk about things that are not fair or just, and to change that system, to make sure that there are employers that respect humans as workers, workers as humans, and that we are there to increase their productivity and that we should share in that as well.
So, Brooke Thomas, not every layoff is a result of greed. And also, when somebody literally can't take a bathroom break because of productivity, that is dehumanizing. So, before we take a pause in our conversation, where do we find that balance? And especially in a state where it is so expensive that everybody needs to be able to work for a living wage and in a dignified manner.
Absolutely. And I, you know, certainly there are bad actors out there. I do think from my perspective and seeing all the industries, the majority of employers recognize, again, in this day in which we live, that they have to be the employer of choice. They have to be respectful. They have to take into account things that maybe 10, 20, 30 years ago, you didn't have to take into account.
So you're saying the power really is in the employee's hands in a way that maybe it wasn't a few years ago.
I think so, but I also look at it at AIM as it's the employees and the employers together. It's not a one side versus the other. It's everybody together talking and having a dialogue about what is needed and everybody being at the table to find those solutions. And I think we're making progress there, but we can't let our foot off the gas as we head through 2024 to make sure that that dialogue continues and that everybody has that equal voice.
You're listening to Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering, and we are having a conversation about the economy and business here in the Commonwealth as we move into 2024. Our guests, Darlene Lombos of Greater Boston Labor Council, Tomas Gonzalez of Amplify Latinx, Brooke Thompson of Associated Industries of Massachusetts, and Jen Fagel of Commonwealth Kitchen, the nonprofit organization. Now, in our remaining time, the agenda is, hey, 2024, here's what has to happen. We've touched on a number of themes, from wages and job security to housing, transportation, access to capital, support in scaling up, building trust between large-scale businesses and the micro and small businesses, especially those owned by underrepresented business owners that will help bring folks forward. All kinds of stuff on the table. I kind of just want to go, on your mark, get set, go. In 2024, the top imperatives. Who wants to jump in first?
I'm happy to go first. I think we have...
This is Brooke talking. Go ahead, Brooke.
We have to all be aligned in recognizing that we have to have a shared goal of being successful. And that means looking at the economy holistically. It means looking at what's driving success, what's allowing for lending, what's opening up lending, what's sending signals to employers to hire. You know, at AIM, we've done our business confidence index since 1991. And that's literally, we go out monthly to businesses across the state and we say, what are you seeing? What are you thinking? What are the problems? What's working? Are you optimistic? And throughout 2023, it oscillated, you know, above 50 or below 50. Above 50 is optimistic, below 50 is pessimistic. And so what that says is nobody really knows, right? Back, Tiziana, to your earlier discussion about the historians, nobody really knows. But what we do know is that when we sit down and we talk, unlike what's going on in Washington, right? When we do what we do really well in Massachusetts, which is bringing all of the different interests together to talk and talk about real problems, but real solutions, we can get things done. And that's why, you know, the one thing I'm going to say that AIM is focused on is getting the Francis Perkins Workforce Equity Law signed into law. This would bring about wage equity and wage transparency here in Massachusetts. And again, set us apart from our other Absolutely. States who are trying to compete for our talent.
Go, Tomas.
Absolutely. Yeah, no, I mean, you got me excited because that's one of our priorities at Amplify Latinx, the Wage Equity Now bill. Parity on Board, another bill that would help tremendously. Common Start bill, the micro business lending bill. These are all things that the state could do. We have to commend the governor for her work to this point, putting people together in the room, coming up with these plans so that we can begin to move the needle forward. Biggest fear, revenue, you know, $400 million now. What does that look like next year? How does that impact the budget and everything else that's sort of in play? And in many ways, does that mean any cuts for us now? In the you know, any 9C cuts for anything that's already been sort of allocated or appropriated? And so, you know, there's fear out there about what's going on. But yeah, there's tremendous hope about what the governor and other folks are doing, whether it's on the local level with Mayor Wu or others. But everyone is sort of stepping up to the table and working collaboratively to make sure that we move Massachusetts and the Commonwealth forward.
So 9C is mid-budget cuts. Wage Equity Now is heavily focused on a disclosure of wage or salary ranges for people in hiring positions. Who was that started to talk? Darlene.
Darlene's got it. It's okay.
Okay. I appreciate that. I was just going to comment on this employer of choice. I love that Brooke has talked about this. In Massachusetts, we need to make sure that we have employers of choice. And for us at the AFL-CIO, Greater Boston Labor Council, it really does mean employers that are investing in their workers, that are actually talking to their workers about what are the problems that are happening in the workplace and in their communities that we can solve together. And I think that's an important part of investing in our workforce and the employer of choice. And I would just want to say one last thing about one of the policies that both the state and city level that would actually get us to this triple win of what the Biden-Harris administration wants us to do around infrastructure funds is project labor agreements that our unionized workforce can actually diversify, get more women and people of color into the trades, into these infrastructure jobs. And we're seeing it right now. Our electricians are doubling, tripling the amount of women and people of color in their apprenticeship program. And we're seeing the effects in the communities already.
And historically, that has been a significant issue in Greater Boston for our listeners who are not aware, the locking out of women of people and people of color in our trades.
Yeah, so appreciate all of that. And I would just say from the Commonwealth Kitchen perspective, you know, we're excited to see what Mayor Wu and Governor Healey are doing and how they are collaborating in a really powerful way. What we have been doing in the nonprofit sector, the work that we do with Tomas and Amplify Latinx and the Black Economic Council of Mass and many other nonprofits that were involved during COVID with equitable PPP advocacy.
Rural Protection Program.
and other work that are we are continuing to build those coalitions to really understand how do we work together as partners to really move things forward. And what I want to continue to do is challenge the bigger companies that are doing this to say, how are you moving from lots of good talk into real action? And so just a very real example of this is in the city of Boston, they put out all of these space grants, right? These $250,000 at a pop grants to minority-owned businesses to open retail spots in the city of Boston. At Commonwealth Kitchen, we have 5 or 6 of our businesses that have gotten these grants. Not one of them has opened a business in the city of Boston. Why? Because the real estate market is still too high, and those real estate developers are still expecting rents at a place that is long gone and need to be looking and thinking differently, need to be coming to the table to think about, again, values aligned, long-term plan, what is our strategy? And so for me, there is a real need to continue to get private industry into deeper conversation about this. And then just one other policy thing I'll put on the table around the access to capital is the public bank. There's been a lot of conversation for Massachusetts to be the first in the nation. North Dakota has something, but the first in the nation to have a public bank. That would really open the door in a much more powerful way to access to capital, even beyond what these mission-based lenders are doing. We struggle to get our businesses access to capital, even from those organizations that are supposedly mission-based lenders. And there's lots we can talk about why. But things like a public bank can be a real solution to
that. Okay, so I want to clarify a couple things you said in a second. But before I do, what is a public bank? What is it?
So literally, it's the bank. It's the government saying we are going to invest our capital into our own bank system rather than into more traditional banking.
Okay.
That money will then be invested into projects that we understand are values aligned with what the Commonwealth's trying to do.
And I do want to note, we've done a couple of segments, including talking with Boston Mayor Michelle Wu about the space grants. The idea was to make it easy for new businesses to lease space in sort of open shell parts of downtown Boston that have not recovered from COVID. And you're saying, yes, somebody wasn't in on the, didn't get the memo,
right.
You're saying,
exactly.
Which is real estate developers, and they are holding back what could be a solution.
Exactly right.
And I think those are steps we can still take. You know, at AIM, we stepped up, and all the space grantees, we gave them AIM membership so that they can come in and we can help them with HR support. They're primarily small businesses. They don't have HR support on hand to help navigate some of these conversations, to try to have some connections with lending institutions, with commercial real estate folks. So again, that's where everybody's got to step up to the table and provide that support, because we're not all operating from a level playing field right now. And so if we're going to be successful, those folks do need to step up and play a role.
So the last question, maybe not the last, depends on how long it takes to answer it. I might have time for more, I might not. And I'm thinking, Tomas and Darlene, maybe I'll direct this to either of the two of you. What about our education system? What about our pipeline? You know, I'm mindful that there are several initiatives right now to allow people to move into the tech industry straight out of high school and then begin to pursue higher education while working in parts of the tech industry. What about the moves at the state level in the new budget to provide free community college education for people over the age of 25 and for people in some careers under the age of 25? You know, how are we doing there? What else do we need to do in our, you know, we have some community colleges that do training with businesses to not just train people and then leave them on their own to get a job, Darlene, but move them into a job.
Right.
So what needs to happen in education in 2024?
Well, I did say this earlier. We're really just excited about all of our unions being able to look at developing apprenticeship programs and pre-apprenticeship programs. I mean, our construction trades have really paved the way to have an example of what this could do to make sure that women and people of color are in these industries. But every apprenticeship program is going to look differently. But again, getting away from this train and pray model, which has been really hurtful to our communities and communities of color, can really help with the way that education can be looked looked at more holistically. Not everyone's going to have a pathway to college, but there are absolutely other ways that we can make sure that the women and people of color in particular are prioritized for training in all sets of industries and sectors. And that could be done through an apprenticeship program, pre-apprenticeship programs.
And Tomas, either pick it up there or in our remaining time, other steps that have to happen for business contracting. You know, Jen mentioned BECMA, the Black Economic Council of Massachusetts. The last time the head of BECMA was here, that was the big thing that she said, this is what we need. We need better contracting for businesses owned by people of color. So either one in our last minute or so.
Yeah, I mean, I'll piggyback off the pathways. We're working in collaboration with the Latino Economic Development Corporation out of Springfield to do a pathway for high school students into the childcare industry and construction. And so that collaboration happens at the community level with the schools, with all of these partners. And that, in our eyes, is really the only way someone is really going to understand their craft and have a passion for that job, aside from the traditional way people have gotten into these roles. But to your second point or the question, I missed it.
That's
I was thinking about the pathways.
That's all right. So one thing that would help.
Oh, on the contracting.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, I mean, I mentioned it earlier. There are a lot of archaic and arduous contracts and RFPs that are put out, the lowest bid. All of these things negatively impact smaller businesses that don't have the resources, don't have the energy and time to put into these, you know, RFPs. And oftentimes, you know, more often than not, don't have the insurance or other pieces to align with that. You have to become certified first. You have to jump into the combine system. You have to learn how to navigate that. You have to see an opportunity that makes sense to you. I mean, it's not easy.
So simplify, simplify, simplify.
Absolutely.
Amen.
And on that, and with an amen, we will end the show. Tomas Gonzalez is with Amplify Latinx. Jen Fagel is Commonwealth Kitchen. Darlene Lombos, Greater Boston Labor Council. And Brooke Thompson, Associated Industries of Massachusetts. Thanks for helping us start the year here on Radio Boston. Thanks so much.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.